Try a subscription to Gardener's World magazine for just $14.99 and find inspiration for your garden. You and a loved one can enjoy two-for-one entry to hundreds of gardens nationwide. Visit buysubscriptions.com/May24 to subscribe.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This is not the sound of a stream running through the mountains. It's water from a leaking pipe trickling down a stairway. That's not a frog splashing into a lake. It's a piece of sheetrock falling into a puddle on a kitchen floor. And that's not a hiker taking a deep breath of mountain air. It's a homeowner gasping at the sight of a $12,000 water damage repair bill. 40% of homeowners have experienced water damage. Protect your home with the Moen Smart Water Monitor and Shutoff. Moen.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the BBC Gardener's World magazine podcast, brought to you by the team here at the magazine. Join us as we chat all things gardening with the nation's favourite experts.
It's long been known that gardeners tend to be healthier and longer living, but only recently has it been discovered that there are medical reasons for this, beyond the mental stimulus that comes from enjoying a hobby. Scientists have revealed that gardeners are influencing their immune systems through contact with soil and microbes every time we go to work in our gardens. So how can you as a gardener ensure you're doing the right thing to boost your health? Hello, I'm Lucy, and in today's episode, we hear from Dr. Michael Mosley on how every gardener has the means to improve their health and immune system through a homegrown diet and active time in the garden, doing what we all love. And he reveals how our mental well-being is influenced too, by simply being immersed in the great outdoors. So I started by asking him about his own research into this and what has been the most extreme way he has experimented on himself in search of better health.
I'm not sure it was really in the pursuit of health. Well, sort of. It was when I infected myself with tapeworm. And my wife was not crazy about this. She's a GP, but I assured her I'd be able to get rid of it. And I was actually doing it in order to see the impact on my immune system, because we know that once upon a time, you know, a couple of hundred years ago, things like asthma, eczema and other forms of allergic disease were very uncommon, and people tended to die of things like TB and smallpox and things like that. And one of the ideas is that in the modern world, we have become much more clean. This is known as the hygiene hypothesis, and that actually particularly the sort of tapeworms and other worms that used to infect our ancestors had a role in damping down the immune system. So I went off to check that out, and a good way to do that was to go and infect myself with tapeworm.
Delightful. But you did manage to shed it, obviously. They came out.
I did, yes. We actually measured my immune response at various points in the experiment. We weren't 100% certain, because what happened is I actually swallowed three cysts. And obviously I had no idea whether they had taken root or not. I didn't lose any weight. The tapeworm diet does not work, as far as I can see. And it was only the agreement I had with my wife is I would get rid of them before they reached full maturity, which is when they sort of start to emerge. And she obviously wasn't keen on that. What happened is I swallowed a pill camera and you could actually see the tapeworm down in my gut. And at the same time, we could also measure the fact that my immune system was changing in response to allergens. Particularly, I'm prone to hay fever. So the experiment worked from that point of view. And it was a fascinating insight into the immune system, but also the role that parasites play in shaping our behaviour.
And really, this is quite a new form of sort of science and discovery. I mean, I think in terms of the sort of sexiness as to where you would go in your medical training, I don't suppose it was right up there in the way that now we're so much more aware of the purpose of our immune system. Not least since lockdown, we've become obsessed about, how our immune system is working. And I think looking at it from a gardening point of view, you know, we tend to think of that as an innately healthy thing to do. But there's a sort of intersection, I think, isn't there, between gardening and our immune system. So I thought we could start to explore that here, you know, in terms of ways that as a gardener, how can you influence your immune system through what we do as, through our hobby?
Absolutely. Well, it's actually, again, tied back to the worm experiment. But what we've also discovered is there are other creatures that live in and on us, microscopic creatures. Obviously, tapeworm grow up to, 5 meters long. We have 100 trillion microbes that live in our gut. They're known as the gut microbiome. And there are 1,000 different species down there. You can think of it as either a forest, a jungle, or a garden, your own gut garden. And these species, these creatures, these microbes have co-evolved with us, and they have helped to shape our immune system in a very profound way. In a similar way, if you like, that the worm does. But the worm does it to protect itself, where these microbes, they do it for mainly to proliferate. But for example, again, we know that possibly because the microbial richness has reduced over the last 50 or 60 years, that is also again linked to the rise of allergies, eczema and other things like that. And one way we know that you can boost your microbiome, you can boost the diversity of the microbes in your gut is by gardening. We know that exposing yourself to bugs in the grass, in the soil, in the air, when you're outdoors, these have a profoundly helpful effect on your microbiome. And obviously, the produce you eat also will have an effect on it.
So it's not just eating things that might have a speck of dirt on it, which my granny was always very fond of saying, eat a speck of dirt before you die. But it's more than that, actually. It's just being literally in and amongst, perhaps having your hands literally in the soil.
Absolutely. And they will transfer from your hands because we're very good at rubbing our eyes, licking our fingers and things like that, even when we don't intend to. Beyond that, you will actually inhale a certain amount, but it's mainly through the sort of the contact of the skin that they get into you. And indeed, there is research showing that beneficial bacteria enter your system that way. And we know that having a diverse microbiome, it's called the Simpson Index. I've had my own measured. I've sent my poo samples off to be looked at. Who wouldn't want to know it was down there? And I have a reasonable Simpson Index, but not compared to, say, some of the hunter-gatherers like the Hadza, who live in Tanzania, and they've been studied, and they kind of have pretty well the healthiest poo on the planet. And that's partly because they obviously have a very rich and varied diet. They're not so much gardeners, but they do eat an awful lot of sort of grubs and bits and pieces they pick up here and there. So diversity is the key, and being in contact with the soil seems to be hugely important for that.
Can you have too much of a good thing? Is it possible to ingest too much of that?
Well, yeah, because there are also some pretty nasty, lethal bacteria out there. You're unlikely to find them in the soil, or at least, pretty unlikely. And microbes, they come, in infinite number of varieties. Some of them you could classify as good, some as bad, amongst the ones that are in your gut. But again, it's kind of about the balance of the ones you have down there. There are some, it seems to be one of the ways they operate is by manipulating your immune system. They can basically tune it up tune it down. And by doing that, they also produce things like inflammatory factors, because your immune system is not only for fighting bugs. What it also does is it can attack your own tissue and lead to something called chronic inflammation. And you don't want that. And that seems to be one of the ways by which things like the Mediterranean diet, fruit and veg, and indeed spending time outdoors in nature, gardening, that seems to be one of the ways that it reduces chronic inflammation, which in turn has quite a profound effect on things like mood, heart disease, cancer, and things like that. So it's a really complicated picture, but fascinating, truly, truly fascinating.
It's incredible, isn't it? Because, you know, we all feel, having come in from a good session of gardening, we all feel better for it, and for all sorts of reasons, probably. But, you know, that's obviously sort of, you know, emotional. But there's obviously a lot more going on there than perhaps we realise. When did this start to sort of emerge as something more than just that, well, literally a gut feel?
Really, relatively recently, and that was because previously we couldn't measure the creatures in our gut. And if you can't measure it, scientists find it very hard to study. So we have known for some time that gardening, people who garden tend to be healthier. They tend to, you know, maintain their weight and, you know, they tend to live in a good old, to ripe old age quite often. But they didn't, it was obviously associated with the activity. It was associated with the fact that you're, you know, enjoying it, you're relaxed, you're out of yourself. But the impact on the microbes, that's been relatively recently, and that's because only relatively recently have we been able to measure the DNA, if you like, because most of the creatures that live in your gut, you cannot grow. And so what they would do is they would take stool samples, they would grow some things, but not much. Nowadays, what they can do is they can look at the DNA, and therefore they can see fragments of DNA, and based on that, they can work out what is living in your gut. And once you can do that, you can start to manipulate the diet, you can start to see the impact that these different microbes are having. And it is an unbelievably complicated picture down there. But it's really, I would say, last 25, 30 years. And, you know, if you'd talked to people 20 years ago about the microbiome, they would have looked dazed. Now everyone knows about probiotics, prebiotics, or at least they sort of know about it. But it's become commonplace to talk about it.
And there are, the good thing is there are ways that you can actually influence it, and they're becoming clearer and much more sort of direct, and you know, we've got an ability to influence it, which seems to be the key.
Absolutely. And that's, again, one of the things, because you can measure it, you can see the changes that occur when you change your diet, for example. We know that a diet, what I would characterize as a Mediterranean style diet, that's one which is rich in fruit and vegetables, olive oil, oily nuts, oily fish and things like that. That has quite a profound effect on the microbiome. It shifts it in a healthier direction. We know that spending time outdoors, gardening does that. We know that exercising does that. So a lot of things which we know are good for us, it turns out they are also good for the microbiome. But the things that are bad for the microbiome are also pretty bad for us, and they would include eating lots of junk food. There are things called emulsifiers in them, which are used to preserve the shelf life of foods, but your microbiome will not enjoy them. And ditto, you know, dosing yourself in lots of antibiotics is not a great thing from the point of view of the microbiome, because it struggles to come back. And just as we have, you know, devastated the planet, number of species dropping off, we know that the number of species in the modern gut is a fraction of what it would have been 50, 100 years ago, and a fraction of what the hunter-gatherers like the Hadza have. So we're devastating our gut garden through the overuse of antibiotics and junk food and not enough fiber and all that healthy stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, really, that whole sort of phrase, you know, nature is a healer. It's genuinely able to sort of help you back onto your feet again if you have had a dose of, say, antibiotics and can cope with it that way. Let's talk specifically about what some of that kind of plant-based diet that we're all being encouraged to move towards. What are the health benefits behind that? And what are some of the key elements of a good plant-based diet that we ought to be moving towards? And of course, as gardeners, we could start growing them.
Absolutely. And the joy of growing it is it's incredibly fresh, because one of the problems with fruit and vegetables is they sometimes come a very long way. And as you know, the nutrient content of often drops away with time. And so a lot of foods can take a while before they reach the plate. Whereas if you grow them yourself, you have the joy. I grow, when I say I mean my wife, grows quite a lot of different crops in the garden, and I must admit I love it. We know, for example, again, it's about range, it's about colour. We know that each of those different colours represents a different phytonutrient, and that means a sort of a chemical which the plant produces to protect itself, which seem to be very good for our health. They're antioxidants, they're flavonoids, and they are things like that. So it's all about colour and variety and trying to get a rainbow plate, try and get as many different colours on the plate as you can, because that way you're going to be getting a very wide range of these phytonutrients. I mean, once upon a time, you know, I used to play a game where I would say, okay, count backwards from 100, take away 3, and then I say name a vegetable and people would just go carrot. It was the only vegetable that came to mind. Whereas I'm pleased to say these days people are more likely to answer with a variety of answers like broccoli or, you know, whatever it might be. So it's about a range of colours, but also there are clearly some particularly one broccoli. I can't say I'm crazy about broccoli, but it is unbelievably nutritious. Spinach, anything which has kind of decent amounts of fibre in it is going to be good for you. Legumes are very underused, not much grown, obviously, in gardens, but increasingly being grown in the UK, things like lentils. They are, certainly from the point of view of the planet, one of the most nutritious foods, but also one of the most environmentally friendly, because they produce surprisingly little carbon dioxide per sort of calorie of nutrient that you get out of them. So I'm a big fan now of including more of those, and more lentils, more beans, more kidney beans, white beans, haricot beans. And I said, I used to hate them, but I've been persuaded, let's put it that way. My wife is a great cook. She writes all those sort of recipe books, and so she's very inventive with these foods. And you have to glug quite a lot of olive oil in, seems to be the secret, as far as I can see, to make them palatable.
Oh, well, that's pretty good. Yes, I mean, there's some delicious recipes at the back of, you know, the Clever Guts Diet and so on. And, you know, because I do grow a lot of vegetables, it's great to see, you know, a few interesting, you know, ways to use veg, because I think it's a massively sort of under-tapped and underdeveloped area. But, I mean, things like growing broad beans, great for protein, as well as, you know, really easy to grow. Lots of beans are easy to grow in the garden. But you were talking there about phytonutrients. Tell us a little bit more about what they do for us. You know, so yes. What are some of those benefits for phytonutrients?
So phytonutrients are one of the classes of chemicals that plants produce, and we know that they have a sort of powerful antioxidant effect, and oxidation is one of the processes that go on inside your body. It produces things called free radicals, which kind of zap around and tend to damage your arteries and other sort of parts of your body. It's part of the process of aging. Aging is an accumulation of damage. If you think of a car sort of rusting and getting a bit knackered, that's probably a reasonable metaphor for your body. And what these phytonutrients do is they help to combat the action of that. They also tend to be quite powerfully anti-inflammatory in and of themselves, but also because of their action on the microbiome. And as I was saying, aging, a lot of the problems with aging go with inflammation. There's actually a word for it, inflammaging. And inflammaging basically helps to explain a lot of the illnesses that go along with aging, which would include arthritis, heart disease, dementia, cancer, and things like that. So a lot of the emphasis or the research now, which is looking into aging and maintaining good metabolic health, is interested in seeing how you can dampen down this chronic inflammatory response. And diet seems to be a big part of it. Eating a diet of the type I described, not just because of the impact of the phytonutrients, but they help, but also because of the impact on the microbiome. So they seem to be beneficial in all sorts of different directions. But primarily what they're doing is helping reduce inflammation, chronic inflammation, which, as I said, seems to go hand in hand with getting a bit older. So when you get out of bed and you creak a bit, that's kind of part of part of inflammaging. You now have a word to go with it.
New word, but yes, that's how you can feel after a heavy session in the garden as well.
Yes.
Definitely a lot of creaking going on there. But how much do we need to eat for it to be of value? You know, at what point, you know, it's a lot talked about five a day. It's, you know, this notion that actually it's just a bit of hype, really. We should be eating more, but we should be eating specifics. So what about the quantities and the variety that we should be eating?
Well, broadly speaking, you should be 5 days kind of a minimum. And some people talk 7, 9. You know, if you love veg, then just top it up. We have veg in most meals. I typically will have, say, an omelette for breakfast, and I'll put in some of the green stuff left over from last night, or I'll chop up a bit of spinach and throw that in. We normally have vegetable soup, or maybe we'll have, you know, a bit of fish with some veg for lunchtime. My wife has just been making aubergine brownies, and which are delicious recipes available, but and we also make our own sauerkraut, so that's basically pickled cabbage. I like it with beetroot, gives it a lovely color. I like red cabbage, that really is just onions, red cabbage, beetroot, and salt and thyme. And making sauerkraut, fermented foods, is really good fun because you have to kind of burp them every morning to get the gas out when it starts appearing. I would strongly recommend having a go because it gives you all the kind of benefits of the veg, but added ones as well, which come in the form of the bacteria, because what happens is you get these sort of lovely probiotics growing in the sauerkraut. And there's a lot of evidence now of the benefits in terms of, again, they go down into your gut and they help reinforce the good ones down there, the good guys and gals who are already down in your gut. So we know, again, that if you buy them industrially processed, then generally they've been pasteurized and there's not that much goodness in them, but or not as much. But if you make it yourself, brilliant, really tasty. Can send you the recipe, but it's really, really simple. Goes wonderfully well with scrambled eggs and things like that. So we try and cram in quite a lot of different veg, but the average Brit is only consuming about 2 a day. So there's a long way to go. If you can do more, then lots of ways of, you know, doing so. The more the merrier, as far as I can see. And a lot of it's about fiber as well. Ideally, you should be aiming to about 30 grams of fiber again a day. Most Brits are hitting something like 10 to 15. And if you want fiber, then you need to go for the legumes. You need to go to kidney beans, because green veg has some, but not that much, to be honest. You actually get more of it from things like whole grains, and particularly from legumes. That's where you'll find it. So, I'm a big fan of every sort of veg, and anything that looks interesting and different, I'll buy it and give it a go. And it doesn't matter if it's frozen, tinned, well, tinned not great, but frozen or fresh, you know.
That's the thing with the garden, you can try so many different things. You know, a packet of seeds is, you know, maybe £3, £4 to try something new, you know, whether it's kohlrabi or fennel or, you know, many things that are a bit fibrous, certainly things you can put into fermenting. And, you know, fresh from your back door. So I had a glut of cucumbers, made a pickle from that. I've got cabbage. I've certainly got a glut of cabbage along the way. And I've seen your fermenting recipe for that. I'm definitely going to do some sauerkraut from that. But we'll put it on the website, actually. So the website linked to the podcast, so people can give it a try themselves. The other thing I know that increasingly is certainly amongst my foodie friends, and I love it too, are things with bitter flavours.
Mm.
And there's a lot of attention now on growing things like chicory and so on that have got that sort of bitter. What is it about a bitter flavour that's maybe been missing from our diet that's coming back maybe out of sort of food fashion, but it's good for us too, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, the problem with bitterness is one of those things which historically has been a sort of signal for poison. So on the whole, young children are averse to bitter things because, you know, that is one of the signals. Now we know that lots of bitter foods are also excellent for us, whether it is broccoli or whatever. As you say, you can overcome your inertial aversion to it. There are some people who are called super tasters, and they do really struggle with very bitter fruits and vegetables because they just, you know, it just is over. But most of us aren't super tasters. You can apparently tell by looking at your tongue. You can count the number of papillae on the end of your tongue, and that will give you some indication if you're a super taster or not. You probably know if you're, because you probably find bitter things difficult. But no, bitter things also... There is a kind of a notion in science known as hormesis, which is also that which does not kill you makes you stronger. And so there is an element of, you know, the bitterness really does convey the sense there may be sort of small amounts of sort of almost poisonous stuff. But actually, taken in very small amounts, this is more of a stimulant than going to knock you off. So I think that's kind of where it comes into it. But like you, I love bitter things. I've kind of would have been averse to them a while ago, but I've taught myself to enjoy them. And I think you can. It's part of the whole, you know, it's exploring your palate. It's trying all sorts of different stuff. And when you were talking about it, things like chicory, fantastic. You know, you have... And the other thing which people... I started talking about probiotics. These are the living bacteria that grow in things like fermented foods. And then there's the prebiotics, which are the foods which help to feed the microbiome. And they're the things like inulin is a particularly good prebiotic, and you find that in abundant amounts in things like chicory and in some of the bitter vegetables. So, yeah, prebiotics, probiotics, you know, pile them on the plate.
Yeah, and there's a big movement now for foraging and going out and finding and eating young leaves. So, you know, dandelion leaves are again, you know, related to chicory, and quite a few seeds coming in from Italy where they have a sort of much wider range of chicory-type leaves that we might have thought of are just as weeds. You know, but actually they are delicious and just added to a salad, you know, just add that little bit of extra bite. And foraging is kind of interesting because we're getting into eating nettles and or rediscovering, putting at this, because it is a rediscovery, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember when I was 8 years old in a biology lesson, and the teacher there was, I have no idea why I remember it, but I remember him talking about nettles. And I remember him saying that nettles were rich in iron, that they were incredibly cheap, obviously, and that we should give it a go. So here we are, nearly sort of 55 years later, and I can still remember him telling me that story. I've never done it, I must admit. But I swear at nettles a lot. I pull them up. But I've never tried. Apparently, they have to be very young.
Yes.
And I'm told they are sort of like spinach a bit, perhaps, maybe.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Well, first of all, always use rubber gloves. Yeah, definitely don't go. So, in the autumn, yeah, don't touch nettles then. But in the spring, you know, May time when they first come through, actually delicious and then just steamed. You can include them in, you know, soups and on all sorts. So they really do have a sort of delicious flavour. They certainly are like spinach. But yeah, you've got to approach with caution because they certainly have a real sting in the tail.
I think that's good. I also like the idea of getting my revenge on the nettles by eating them young.
Yes, exactly. You know, and, you know, of course, people used to spray pesticide all over them. But now, really, you just, you know, no one's touching that, hopefully, anymore in the garden. So we've got to find our way. You know, if you can't beat them, eat them.
And there's the other advantage with foraging, which means you're going to be outdoors, you're going to be in the sunshine, you're going to be spending time in green spaces, ideally. And again, we know that that is hugely beneficial for our mental and our physical health. And indeed, if you can spend time in forests, we know that trees produce a sort of a range of volatile chemicals, which seem to be good for our immune system and good for our mood. There was a study done in Japan where they're particularly keen on what they call forest bathing, and they found that spending time in a wooded area boosted levels of things called natural killer cells, which are part of your immune system. So I'm very fortunate. I have a forest just down the road from me, and so I go and run or walk in it almost every day, sometimes twice a day. And I haven't been foraging there. I'm not sure there's anything forageable there, but I'll have a look.
You never know. You never know. It's worth a look. But I mean, even, well, the idea that we should all be planting more trees is so prevalent at the moment. The environment demands it. And in fact, just planting one or two trees of your own, I would have thought would start to connect you. You know, even in an urban plot where all you can see around you is concrete or bricks or whatever, certainly introducing trees, I would have thought even on a small scale, will that have an influence?
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, a few years ago, I presented a series called Trust Me, I'm a Doctor on BBC Two. And we did an experiment where we decided to just introduce some silver birch trees in tubs outside houses on quite a busy road. Now, when the producer suggested this to me, but he said there was some studies showing that introducing trees cuts down indoor air pollution, I thought it's never going to work. But we decided to do it anyway. So we planted the birch trees, as I said, in tubs outside the houses. And what we did is we kind of measured the level of indoor pollution, mainly coming, obviously, from the road. The microparticles, which are so bad for your health, we measured those on the television set and around there. And then we came back about 6 weeks later and we measured them again. And there was a significant reduction. The little old silver birch trees outside had been trapping the pollutants coming from the diesel lorries and trucks that were going by and actually having an impact on the quality of the air in the houses. And when it rained, all the pollutants that they'd trapped in their leaves would just sort of wash off and go down the drain. And I thought that was just really rather wonderful. And so if you do live anywhere near a busy road, then planting some trees outside your house could be hugely beneficial.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I think I've read similar research. And in fact, if you can plant evergreens, all the better. And that sort of sticky, hairy leaf of an evergreen will often trap even more. So it's extraordinary what we're discovering now. But you've discovered gardening relatively recently. I think I've read that a bit like so many people in lockdown, you took up a bit more gardening.
Absolutely. My wife has always been a keen gardener. I tend to get hauled out to just dig things up when necessary. But we're fortunate. We live in sort of semi-rural area. We have a decent-sized garden. And Claire has been busy chopping and cutting and things like that. She does try... I wouldn't say I'm the most active gardener in the world, but I'm more of a theoretical gardener, to be honest. I do enjoy listening to Gardener's World. I do enjoy watching programmes on the telly, and I do enjoy the end product. I mean, I'm good at picking the raspberries and the strawberries and the tomatoes and the green beans and things like that. But my knowledge is at best superficial, but I'm an enthusiast, let's put it that way.
But the two brains together, I can see, are making amazing things probably in the garden in terms of what you're growing. So tell us what's in the garden. What's in the Moseley family garden at the moment that you might be picking from for a sort of healthy meal in the next few weeks?
Absolutely. Not very much right at the moment. So the tomatoes we've come to the tail end of, the strawberries and raspberries have all gone. Green beans pretty well gone. There's a little bit of spinach still left. There's a bit of lettuce, although I'm afraid it looks as though it's bulky. And there is some rhubarb. So I do love rhubarb. So those are the main things. Other than that, we've been out doing the last of the blackberry picking. And we also have some apple trees. So we got some windfall apples. And so pretty well every meal has apple in some form or another. I do like blackberry and apple pie. And the rest of it goes into freezer. But I got bucket loads of that. And I've actually, as we had enough apples this year, we made some apple juice out of it. And I'm attempting to make cider as we speak. It's downstairs. I haven't dared remove the cover to see if it's actually bubbling away or not, but I chucked in the yeast and standing back and waiting to see whether it will transform itself into a delicious cider or not.
Yes, that can be quite explosive, but they're interesting. Apples are one of the real super fruits, aren't they? Tell us a little bit more about apples. That's quite an incredibly important fruit for us.
Absolutely. So it's kind of obviously along with bananas, they are one of the most eaten fruits in the UK. I do love sort of variety and I like very tart apples. So we know that I always eat them with, you know, you've got to eat the whole thing. Most of the goodness is in the skin. It's like potatoes. I never understood why I spent my youth having to peel potatoes when these days I just give them a cursory scrub and chop them up. Never, ever, ever do I peel potatoes anymore. And the same is true of apples. As I said, the goodness is in the skin and I eat the whole thing. Sometimes I, including the core, and sometimes I even eat the sort of, you know, the bit at the end, just, you know, give my microbiome something to think about.
Very much so.
apples are full of flavonoids, of all sorts of different things. They're a decent source of vitamin C and other vitamins. They also, you know, they're decent sorts of fiber. I love them sort of chopped up with porridge in the morning or whatever it might be. As I said, in a pie, they are unbelievably versatile. And unbelievably abundant this time of year.
And again, something that we can all grow really easily. Even a relatively small garden can easily fit in a couple of apple trees on small rootstocks, because there is the question, I guess, of, you know, as you say, all the goodness is in the skin. But if you've bought from a shop, you don't know the pesticides that might be on it or any of the chemicals that are on it. So has there been anything that might tell us, is that outweighed actually by the overall benefit of eating, you know, the skin and so on?
I don't think we know. I mean, the other thing is obviously that when you buy apples, they can have been in storage for a very long time. And again, the vitamin C content tends to drop off with time. So the joy of having your own is, as you say, you know it hasn't been sprayed with anything, and you also know it is unbelievably fresh. It has just come off that tree. But with some of the other stuff you buy in shops, you don't know how far it has travelled. I do try, you know, when the apples are not in season, I try to buy them British apples, but for obvious reasons, by the time you hit spring or times like that, most of them have either been in storage for a very long time or they're coming a long way. And we're all very conscious of our carbon footprint, and there is nothing which is going to reduce your carbon footprint more than eating stuff you've grown yourself, which has not had to be, you know, transported hundreds and in some cases tens of thousands of miles.
That's right. And when you choose your own apple to plant, then you can choose something that stores, that's a really good storer all the way through to, you know, March, April, May, or you know, in your own cool shed. So there's certainly a way of kind of extending the apple picking and eating season by just choosing the right variety. So I thought, just to wrap up, just give us one kind of really simple takeaway that you think, that what's the one thing that every gardener should do more of for their health?
I think the one thing they should probably do is encourage their partner, like me, if they're not already doing it, to do it. We know, as I was saying, there are benefits from the hands-on stuff. It's the exercise, it's the activity, it's the socializing. So, yeah, try and motivate other people to join in your passion if you can. I think the more people who take it up, the better.
Yeah, that's great evidence. And of course, there is lovely evidence actually of the more that you have a passion and share it with somebody, the more enjoyment you get out of it and you stick with it.
Absolutely. And also what it means is that it is a gift. It's a gift you're giving to someone else. And one of the things we know happiness, one of the secrets of happiness is both, spending time with people you like. And it is also sharing stuff with people you like and gifting stuff to people you love. All of these things will significantly contribute to your sense of well-being and happiness. Material things are not very effective. You buy the sofa, not a great way of boosting your happiness except for a short period of time. It is these other things that really, truly, truly matter.
Thanks for listening to the BBC Gardeners World Magazine podcast. So, if you've enjoyed this episode, please tell others about it and rate us in your podcast provider app. And we'll see you next time.